Do I sound different? I hope not. But I'm recording here in a currently imperfect setup in our new flat in Oxford, just around the corner from where Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings, and so if any of the sharp-eared among you notice some shifts, that's why, and it's gonna last a couple of episodes whilst I get things sorted out. We're here, finally, on the cusp of starting season two. I'm feeling refreshed and ready. We've got a couple of episodes almost completed and more in the works. Thank you to those who stuck with me while asking when we're getting back to regular service. Today is a step in the right direction. This is our introduction to the early medieval period episode. It's a new idea for an episode. I dived into season one feet first. The narrative was organic and developing constantly. All of which is smart speak to hide the fact that I was flying by the seat of my pants. Every episode was an adventure, and often as much as a surprise to me as it was to you. We're not going to lose that one, not entirely. Since this is a research-led episode, very often the ideas I have at the start of the process are very different from the episode that you hear. For example, our second episode of the season will focus on what happens along Hadrian's Wall after the Romans left. Initially, that episode was going to be about the Poundbury Cemetery, but as I read more and more about Poundbury, no narrative grabbed me. There was little theoretical discussion about the site. Instead, Poundbury felt more like a dataset or a supporting site, and so Poundbury was ditched in favour of Burd Oswald. However, the early medieval period lasts 700 years, which is barely as long as the Iron Age, never mind the half a million years of British prehistory we covered last season. It is more compressed and cohesive from a thematic and narrative sense. So it makes sense at the outset to tell you about that narrative and those themes, so you have an idea of where we're going and how each of the pieces fit together. Consider this the front cover of the jigsaw puzzle, and the rest of the season as an attempt to put that jigsaw together. We'll get to all that in a little while, but before we get there, we need to do the usual round of disclaimers. These, though, aren't the apologies we've all got tired of during my sojourn into interviews. No, these are useful, practical explanations that are going to apply to the rest of the series, and are me trying to get my nose ahead of predictable criticisms. The first is how we talk about dates. Very early on, I made the conscious decision to avoid using phrases like 4th century. I've grown up obsessed with history, and I still get confused by this phrase. In the last series, I referred to dates as how long before present something occurred. Being honest, before presence is a specific archaeological term, which means before 1950, which is another topic entirely. But don't worry, I do the calculations for you. So when I say before present, it means before the first quarter of the 21st century. In between the end of our first series and the start of our second series, something important happens though. Jesus Christ was born. During the before Christ period, I find dates annoying because they follow a different pattern to what we're used to doing in our day-to-day usage. Before Christ, 150, is much later than 200, and that just isn't instinctive to me, so I decided not to use actual dates in season one, only referential dates, as we've just discussed. We don't have that issue here. We are well beyond Jesus' birth and death, and since this period is a much shorter period, simply saying 1,550 years ago doesn't really cut it. We need to be more precise, and so you will start to see a melding together of our old style of 1,550 years ago, and also 450 CE. Yep, CE, not AD. And to be honest, this is why I've decided to go on this disclaimer, rather than just shift to a new model and say nothing. So, CE means Common Era, and AD means Anno Domini, or the Year of Our Lord. CE is becoming the common usage for most academics now. It became popular as one of the many ways scholarship has tried to move away from its roots to make itself more acceptable. I'll be honest, I prefer AD. I've got a Christian background and I find CE somewhat hypocritical. It's only the common era for those who also have a Christian background, and also CE and BCE become quite confusing to read when next to each other. However, this is a show designed to be accessible to the greatest number of people, and so this is a hill I decided to abandon in favour of a trend which isn't going away, so don't at me. How we talk about the past is unavoidably political, and I've tried to take the least contentious route while still being myself, which right now is very often the best one can hope to achieve. Another unavoidable political area is also the names you use when talking about the past. We touched on this in our conversation with David Petz. When we discuss regions, I'll do my best to link them to modern regions, and we're going to try and avoid too many ancient names of locations, except those which were in common usage: Northumbria, East Anglia, Wessex, Mercia, etc. We're also going to use some other terms which have more modern meanings, but are a bit more complex when used in an early medieval context. For example, the term pagan is linked to a whole host of modern religious movements. We're going to use the term pagan to refer to pretty much any religion that isn't Christian during this period. This means that anything the Romans believed before Christianity became super popular, including pre-Roman British religious beliefs. It will also mean the beliefs held by the Saxons before they were converted in the 600s, and those very closely related beliefs held by the Scandinavians when they arrived on the scene in the late 700s and early 800s, until their conversion in the 1000s. Similarly, when we use the term Celtic or British, those are somewhat interchangeable terms in this podcast for the people who do not have Germanic backgrounds, although Celtic will usually be a reference to their culture, while British will refer more broadly to the people themselves. British, until 1066, and maybe even beyond that, does not include the Anglo-Saxons, or the folks who make up most of the population of modern-day England. For those folks who are the ancestors of the majority of modern-day England, we'll refer to those as Saxons, Anglo-Saxons, or Germanic. When we talk about these Germanic invaders or settlers, we're referring to an area which covers what is now the Netherlands, North Germany, and southern Denmark. This is different from the people who we'll call the Vikings much later in this series. Viking will be a catch-all term for the Scandinavians who began to besiege much of northwest and northeast Europe. When they're a violent or transient group, they'll be Vikings. Once they settle, they'll either be Norse or Dane or Norwegian, whatever seems to be the most accurate term at the time of writing. As you might have picked up on, one of the things I love most about this period is how deeply relevant it is to the politics of Europe today. When people hear talk of English or British or Danish or Christian, they very often, even subconsciously, think of themselves. I'll be honest, one of the reasons I love this period is that where I grew up in West Yorkshire, this history feels extremely relevant to modern cultural identities. So the fact that most of the sites we'll discuss are in modern-day England is unavoidable, but also inevitably political. That's because the record is better in England than in Scotland or Wales, both historically and archaeologically. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, Bede, and many others survive better than their British contemporaries, and the sheer economic dominance of modern England has led to a well-publicised bias in archaeological research. It's actually often a feat just to represent anywhere other than southern England, never mind Scotland or Wales. We will attempt to talk about non-English sites whenever we can. For example, they'll be very important in our second episode when talking about how different regions of Britain reacted to the collapse of the Roman Empire. And finally, a few of you have already put in requests for me to talk about named individuals. For example, Alfred looms large, as does the terrifyingly efficient romance between King Canute and Queen Emma. Talking about those individuals scares me. They're all wrapped up in mystery, misunderstanding, and folklore. I know that their existence in the halfway house between real political people and giants of British folk history is what attracts me to them, so I'll bring them in when they are useful, but I can't promise they will ever be more than context or an illusion. That said, there is so much poetry and folklore around this period that I think we've got a strong stream of potential bonus episodes in the second half of this series. If you'd like to work with me to create some mystical, beautiful bonus episodes, join me on Patreon. We can talk and discuss how to give a flavour of early medieval culture direct from their writings, rather than simply the garbage and forgotten things with which we create archaeology. It feels like all these problems would be resolved if we focused more on the archaeological record than the historical record, which is fragmentary and misleading, but hey, that's the world we live in, and it's for a different episode to dig into the whys and whatnots of that debate. So, let's get to some story. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to All Bones. To begin with, I want to give you the high-level narrative. The stories of England, Scotland, and Wales kick off during this period, and there is a much more cohesive narrative than in our previous season. That said, if the political narrative or the history is something that fascinates you as much as the archaeology, I'd recommend the British History Podcast, which goes into everything that follows in loving, humorous detail. Our story begins and ends with France. Well, what is now France. And no, I'm not happy about that fact. However, in the late 300 CE, France was again being invaded by Germans, and they were struggling to hold them back. During the long period of decline that marks the last 200 years of the Roman Empire in the West, the Germanic tribes, through trade and mercenary work, had got to understand how the Romans thought and acted very, very well. So, when a group of rapacious raiders called the Huns began moving in from the east, these tribes decided that fighting the Roman Empire was much better than fighting these wild horsemen from the Asian steppes. Chief among these groups that fled west were the Goths, who caused all matter of chaos, which culminated in the sack of Rome in 410. Remember that year. It's important. You see, all this violence in France and later Italy prompted the Roman Empire to constrain its focus to Gaul and, so the traditional story goes, pull their forces back onto the continent. We'll dig into whether that was actually the case in our first and second episodes. As you can imagine, Britain's disconnection from the centralized Roman system had some profound consequences. What those consequences were exactly is a fertile area of debate and one of the themes we will grapple with throughout the early part of the season. Every region of the UK responds to the end of the Roman Britain differently. However, let's talk through a small but relatively representative example of what happened. About an hour's drive from where I'm recording this episode in the rolling, verdant Cotswold Hills lies soon-to-be Mrs. Bone's favourite archaeological site, Chedworth Roman Villa. It's a grand villa with two bathhouses, a shrine, three or four ranges of buildings, and some of Britain's best examples of domestic mosaics, including one with a depiction of each season in the corners. If you visit my Patreon page, the image advertising the $10 option features a snippet from the Chedworth mosaic that is soon to be Mrs. Bone's favourite snippet of this, her favourite site. The bathhouses, the mosaics, the largest ranges, all of these were built during the early and mid-300s. They represent Roman Britain at its peak. Wealth is flowing within its shores and out to the continent. The symbol of Romanitas, wine, olives, fine ceramics, brooches and fine statuary are flowing across the channel and finding their homes in palatial residence for Britain's many well-to-do citizens. They are expanding, installing underfloor heating on hypercourses, building mosaics and enjoying the good life. The top brass of Roman Britain are eating well in dining rooms lined with bright plaster and floored by fine mosaics with underfloor heating. However, within 75 years of the mosaic's completion, the Roman Empire collapsed. That is a smaller period of time than the period between the debut of this episode in late September 2020 and the end of the Second World War on 2nd of September 1945. That end of Roman control didn't mean the end for Chedworth, though, not yet. You see, that beautiful mosaic is scarred by dark grey patches of destruction. These marks of devastation are not on the edge of the room where the mosaics are weakest or near to the areas where the burrowing of rabbits had undermined and collapsed other portions of Chedworth's mosaic. No, they're in the centre of the room, equidistant from the doorway and the back wall. Those marks were made by braziers. Those hypercourses, the underfloor heating systems popular in the homes of well-to-do Romans, well, the knowledge of how to build, use and maintain those systems had been forgotten or deliberately abandoned. Instead, fires were lit inside the fine halls of Chedworth, leaving scars we can still see today. That shift from a very Roman way of living to a lifestyle that seems on the surface to be a return to the Iron Age is happening all across Britain. Traditionally, Roman rule ends with a letter from the Emperor Honorius to the magistrates of Roman Britain, telling them that the empire would not protect them any longer from the pirates and bandits that were becoming increasingly common. That letter arrived in 410 CE. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle records that in 449, one of these Romano-British elites, King Vortigern, invited Hengist and Horsa, the first Anglo-Saxon, to protect his kingdom. Instead, those warriors stayed and marked the beginning of an influx of a new people, the Anglo-Saxons. This story is considered by most to be hogwash. The Saxons were registered as being involved with British politics since 367 CE, and as we discussed with David Pett's last episode, archaeology is continuing to push the first hints of Anglo-Saxon communities in Britain further from the traditional arrival date of 449 and close to their first interference in Britain in 367. No matter when exactly the Anglo-Saxons arrived, when they appeared in small groups in patches along the east coast. The modern counties of Northumberland, North and East Yorkshire, Cambridgeshire, Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex, Kent and Sussex all played host to these new groups of farmers from the Netherlands, North Germany and South Denmark. It's at this point where we really hit the quote-unquote Dark Ages. It's from this period, which starts in the 450s and runs until the late 500s, that we have a paucity of historical sources combined with some very difficult archaeology. It isn't just that the archaeological remains are often merely dark stains in the soil. It is that, unlike with prehistory, those stains are sandwiched between high medieval archaeology and late Roman archaeology, both of which are far more eye-catching. For much of archaeology's life, awareness and expertise were too limited to be aware or spot the often small smudges which mark out sites from the late 400s and 500s. It's in this shadowy area of historical knowledge that figures like King Arthur live. However, archaeology is revealing an ever more fascinating story, which we are going to shortchange here because the image is too complex to dive into during what is ostensibly an overview. The image we get from sites like Mucking in Essex and Yevering in Northumbria is of small farming communities establishing themselves and over the course of the 500s, developing into larger groups with nascent hierarchies that made a claim on larger and larger swaths of territory. By the time Europe begins recording their engagement with Britain again, there are kings living in vast halls, most famously captured in Beowulf. Actually, rather than try and explain to you what this world was like and risk tumbling down a rabbit hole, let me give you a few lines from Beowulf to give you a sense of the world that established itself by the early 600s. Hrothgar won honour in war, glory in battle, and so ensured his followers' support, young men whose numbers multiplied into a mighty troop, and he resolved to build a hall, a large and noble feasting hall, of which splendours men would always speak, and there to distribute his gifts to old and young, all the things that God had given him, but not men's lives or public land. Then I heard that tribes without number, even to the ends of the earth, were given orders to decorate the hall, and in due course, before very long, this greatest of halls was completed. Hrothgar, whose very word was counted far and wide as a command, called it Heorot. He kept his prime men, gave presents of rings and treasures at the feasting. The hall towered high, lofty and wide-gabled. Fierce tongues of loathsome fire had not yet attacked it, nor was the time yet near when a mortal feud should flare between father and son-in-law, sparked off by deeds of deadly enmity. End quote. In short, this world of sometimes splendid timber buildings, small groups cooperating under the aegis of a king who may control by violence and ostentation. It is a Germanic culture, and there develops a clear distinction between the Germanic side of Britain, which covers what most of what is now England and southeast Scotland, and the British side, or the Celtic fringe, which includes Cornwall, Wales, most of Scotland, and the occasional place like modern-day Lincolnshire and Cumbria, both of which manage to maintain more of their British culture for longer than their neighbours. This reminds us that there isn't one narrative here. The relationship between the Saxons and Britons was complex, and every interaction could range from peaceful and prosperous through wary avoidance to outright warfare and vendetta. Britain at this point is a patchwork quilt of political units. None of these were nice, tidy kingdoms with a clear line of succession. These regions with names like Wessex, Sussex and Essex, or Bernicia, Deira, Lindsay and Elmet, or of course Mercia, Kent and Northumberland, as well as their Welsh, Cornish, Scottish and Pictish neighbours, all had their own rules around who could be king. They also all had different ways of building villages, different types of elite buildings, different pottery and different relationships with the international community. Which brings us to the next big thing in the study of the early medieval period. Broadly speaking, the Saxons were pagan, following gods like Thor and Odin, and the British remained Christian. In 596, Pope Gregory the Great, apparently inspired by seeing some rather beautiful fair-haired English slaves for sale in Rome, sent St. Augustine to found a mission. In 597, Augustine founded what is now the Archbishopric of Canterbury, and began a process of converting the Anglo-Saxons. We need to pick up the story here a bit, so let me just say that the two themes we've established, that patchwork quilt of competing regions and two competing religions, interacted in a complex whirling weave over the next 100 or so years, in a way that was as seemingly indecipherable as Anglo-Saxon metalwork. Over time, by the late 700s, this interplay had led to the development of a set of predominantly Christian kingdoms any fans of The Last Kingdom will be familiar with. In the far north, Pictland was becoming Scotland. Wales, in the west, was particularly unruly and made up of at least 10 separate kingdoms, not including Cornwall, a British kingdom. In England, though, things had started to rationalise. North of the River Humber was tied together into the permanently unstable Kingdom of Northumberland. Across what is now the Midlands, Mercia dominated much of British politics. In the east, across what is now Essex, Suffolk and Norfolk, was East Anglia, a prosperous trading centre whose weak army was a constant temptation for the other powers who seemed to never learn just how difficult the Anglian fens are to cross in any great numbers. And in the south, we have the last kingdom, Wessex. In the late 700s, Wessex was undoubtedly powerful. It controlled not just the southwest of England, but also the Isle of Wight and Kent, two storied kingdoms in their own right. However, you wouldn't have put your money on its descendants still ruling Britain to this day. What turned Wessex's fortunes was the most vicious crisis Britain had experienced since the collapse of the Roman Empire, the arrival of the Vikings. The Viking Age didn't begin, as is often reported, with the sacking of Lindisfarne. No, Lindisfarne was simply the moment when a growing problem went stratospheric. The first recorded Viking raid in England was in 789, 4 years before Lindisfarne's sacking. The story goes that three Norwegian ships bumped up against the beaches of the Isle of Portland, the rocky tip of a narrow peninsula south of Weymouth. That peninsula is famous as playing host to Chesil Beach, which inspired Ian McEwan to write one of his greatest novels called, well, On Chesil Beach. The Norsemen of these three ships were approached by a man called Bjederhird, who was a reeve, a royal servant whose job was to monitor and tax trade. The reason he went to meet the Norsemen was because he thought they were traders. Unfortunately, he was wrong. Instead of paying their toll, they drew an axe and killed the king's reeve. In the century and a half that following that raid, Britain changed forever. Wales was the least bothered by the Viking raids, and it's notable that it is the region changed the least by the Viking incursion. Scotland, for example, unifies under the Scottish kings during this period. This seems to make sense, right, that Scotland should be Scottish? Well, when the Vikings arrive in what is now Scotland, it was split between the native inhabitants of northern Britain, the Picts, and multiple groups of people originally from Northern Ireland, of which the Scotty were the largest group. In England, the change is even more striking. In 866, the Norse had captured York, and by the time they forced King Alfred into the marshes of Somerset in 878, all of England was controlled by the Vikings. Sometimes, like in the northeast of England, Norse control was political, but there was little social or cultural impact of Viking dominance. Other times, like in Yorkshire, Lancashire, and East Anglia, the century or more of Viking domination and migration led to permanent changes in the linguistic, geographical, and genetic makeup of the region. However, as many of you will already know, in these Somerset marshes, modern-day England was born. Over the course of the 900s, a series of powerful Wessex kings and one lady of Mercia, Æthelflaed, slowly pushed back Viking control, which was called the Danelaw, until under Æthelstan, who really should be called Æthelstan the Great or Æthelstan the First, England was unified along broadly modern lines. During this time, we also see a replay of the earlier struggle between Christianity and paganism, except this was the famous Norse version of paganism, which is very similar to that of the Anglo-Saxons before the arrival of St. Augustine. However, it's not the same. It's super important to know that paganism and Christianity might be drawn into comparison and competition during this period, but they are actually very different belief systems. Unlike Christianity, paganism is not a religion for writing down. As the Quran says, Jews, Christians, and Muslims are literally people of the book. The written word is vital to Christianity's identity. In fact, in the Gospel of John, God is literally identified with writing when he is called the Logos, a Greek word which in this context is often translated as the Word. While early medieval Christianity is its own weird beast, which we will explore more this season, the focus on the written word means that the stories being preached by St. Augustine are recognisably related to those you can hear any Sunday in your local church. That's not paganism. Paganism is a religion of stones and rivers, hills, plains, valleys, and trees. Some of the major gods might remain constant, but much of the belief systems of pagan folk evolves in step with how the society develops. So while Odin, and Odin especially, will feature in two big chunks of this series, how he was conceptualized by the Saxons and the Vikings is different. There is a 400-year gap between the Saxon arrival and that of the Vikings. Furthermore, whereas many Saxons did come from southern Denmark, as did some Vikings, the Vikings who raided Britain were predominantly from the rest of Denmark and Norway. These are not the same people, or even the descendants of the Saxons, who stayed put in North Europe. Their faith isn't the same either. Either way, by the year 1000, Britain was finally, undoubtedly Christian. It became a self-aware element of the British identity. This wasn't the only development that took place under the string of successful kings of Wessex. There are two critical developments to note for now. The first is the rise of towns. Starting with Alfred, England becomes more urbanized. There were two major forces acting on this increased urbanization. The first was the increased globalization that emerged as political units became more powerful and populations increased. International trade was becoming more commonplace, and centres like London, Ipswich, Southampton and York, places with good connections to main waterways and sea routes, attracted the ambitious and entrepreneurial. Incidentally, that same globalisation and the associated economic growth was one of the many reasons the Viking Age happened at all. They are what prompted the second major force encouraging Britain's urbanisation. Defence. Here is where Alfred and his descendants become important. The Saxons learn over the course of the 700s that their armies were not good enough to reliably defeat the Vikings in open battle, and they never would be. So Alfred decided to create a series of walled settlements called burhs. Many of those burhs are still important and still bear this Saxon name: Tewkesbury, Glastonbury, Aylesbury, etc. Usually these settlements were already important. Glastonbury, Aylesbury, Oxford, London and Reading were all important settlements which became burhs. Sometimes, though, to fill in the gaps, Alfred created whole new towns. These two factors gave English towns twin functions which promoted each other. On one hand, they were economic centres, usually well suited for trade, attracting the wealthy, ambitious and powerful. On the other hand, they were defensive sites with strong garrisons which again attracted or demanded the attention of the wealthy, ambitious and powerful. The result is that England, far more so than its neighbours, became a country where political powers were located in towns and cities. Linked to this is the other major development, a more sophisticated and centralised system of government. Again, starting with Alfred, there is an interesting blend of native developments and imports from the continent that create a distinctively Anglo system of governance. Elite power became more continental, consciously copying the kings of the Carolingian kingdom, which eventually became France and the Holy Roman Empire, two countries who would spend much of the next 1,000 years arguing which one of them was the true heir of Rome. The reason was that the greatest Carolingian king, Charlemagne, was the first Western European to be crowned emperor in Rome since the collapse of the Roman Empire. Charlemagne became the first Holy Roman Emperor, and it is here that I must point out the eternal truth that while he may have been the first Holy Roman Empire, Charlemagne, like all Holy Roman Emperors, was not really an emperor, was definitely not Roman, and didn't really fit either modern or ancient definitions of holy. What they were was glorious and powerful. And the Saxon kings began to copy how these mighty kings expressed that power by dressing very fancily, killing a lot of animals, and having complex coronations overseen by archbishops. However, the Carolingians didn't really create an effective self-sustaining system of rule, and here Alfred and his descendants drew on traditional Germanic models of government and expanded them to a national level. At the heart of this was the concept of the moot. These are essentially meetings and are the ancestor of the modern British parliamentary system. Moots began to happen at every level of government, from the King's Moot, which was called the Witan, all the way down to the Hundred Moot, which was a meeting held by the group of people living on a land which could support 100 people. This new system was implemented and enforced by new types of officer called reeves. All of which is to say that under these early kings of England, the country was, especially for its time, a unified, wealthy, sophisticated system. In other words, the biggest political prize in Europe. That prize was irresistible to three foreign men, all with Viking backgrounds and a talent for combining bloody, unforgiving slaughter with brilliant political manoeuvring. The first is Svein Forkbeard, who overthrew Æthelred Unred, at once the best-named king in British history and one of the least capable rulers we've ever had, although modern British politics is working very hard to make Æthelred seem great in comparison. Unfortunately for Svein, his takeover of Britain was the culmination of a sparkling career, and he died 5 weeks after taking control of England. The English then kicked out Sven's son, which didn't go down with young Canute, whose title is Canute the Great, which kind of gives the game away before his story really begins. After being kicked out by the English because they fancied giving Æthelred another go, Canute borrowed an army from his big brother Harold and returned a year later and fought a 14-month long war with the second best named king of England, Edmund Ironside. Canute eventually won and arguably founded Britain's first empire by eventually becoming king of England, Denmark, Norway, and, in his own words, some of the Swedes. He also exercised overlordship over Wales and Scotland. Canute loomed large on the world stage, but like his father, didn't know when to stop, and upon his death, his empire was too large and too fragile to be ruled by anyone other than Canute the Great. Our story ends with the last Viking invasions of Britain and the final defeat of the Anglo-Saxon kings. Strangely, though, this last and greatest of Britain's Vikings invaders had decided that he wanted to be French. He was a Norman, and he had the third best name of any English king, William the Bastard, a name he disliked, and so got the much worse epithet, William the Conqueror. William and his descendants continued Alfred's project of combining Anglo-Saxon-style government with a continental flair, and 950-odd years later, we are here, in the modern day, with Elizabeth II. That's the historic story. The overview to contextualise everything we will talk about going forward. However, I think it is here that I have to say again that we are going to be led by archaeology. Archaeology isn't all that concerned with names. Instead, archaeology is interested in understanding how and why societies develop over long periods of time. Not for the first or the last time, I will say that if you want to know all the names and the complex political interweaving that is undeniably one of the best things about this period, then the British History Podcast is your friend. And I wish I had been paid to say that, but it is just a purely personal recommendation that this is a great podcast and has helped me a lot in forming my ideas about this period. Here, though, back to our period. We're on the doorstep of history. The documents are both a blessing and a curse. For one, it's the paucity of documents for much of this period which gives it the epic-sounding but misleading term, the Dark Ages. Now, I think this term sounds awesome. No other name has the romance or mystery of the Dark Ages. Or the Anglo-Saxon Age comes close, but other common terms for this period like lack pizzazz. The early medieval is accurate, but meh. The migration period only refers to a century and sounds somehow medical. The Viking Age is awesome, but equally only refers to the latter half of the period. This isn't a problem we've had previously. Prehistory always sounds cool, as does the standard tripartite division of British prehistory into Stone, Bronze, and Iron Ages. Not only do they have the romance I think is necessary for a good name, but they're also accurate. Okay, maybe they are somewhat technological, but one of the defining features of prehistory is the massive technological advancements, first in stone and later in metal. In this period of ours, the best-sounding name, the Dark Ages, is also the most insulting. It was a name given by traditional historians back in the Enlightenment. They associated civilization and refinement with history and philosophy and stone buildings like the ones that they studied in. The period from the 410s to the 600s is nearly devoid of written contemporary history, and we only get scraps of philosophical thought with people like Alcuin after that time. From the perspective of men like Edward Gibbon, who were writing before archaeology even existed, their lantern into the past, primary documents, was non-existent. The truth is, though, we've not returned to prehistory. But nor can this period be called truly historic. Instead, the early medieval period is a half place, historically and archaeologically shadowy. If you squint and look closely, you get flashes of a fascinating and vibrant world. As the period develops, especially in the later Anglo-Saxon period, we will gain access to more charters, more poetry, more history, some philosophy, and a lot more letters. We'll be able to begin using something approaching proper historical technique to complement our archaeological efforts. However, even then, as I said, the documents are both a blessing and a curse. They're a blessing because even for our earliest times, you have men like Gildas and Bede giving us named individuals and an idea of what people thought about the time immediately after the fall of the Roman Empire, very soon after it happened. As the time progresses, the greater number of documents gives us more of that. However, documents during this period curse us because so often they mislead us or pigeonhole the archaeological evidence we discover into existing documentary narratives. Now, admittedly, this is a problem faced by every archaeologist working in historical periods, but I think the challenge is compounded here. As history develops, we get more sources from more people. For example, when reading a biography of the Black Prince or Eleanor of Aquitaine, we don't just have the charters or the works they commissioned. We also have people writing their personal opinions of those people and people writing history for the enemies of these people. That almost always isn't the case during the early medieval period. Take the early Wessex kings, the men for who we have the best documentary evidence for. Every letter, every charter, and every chronicle is either written for, by, or to the king. Their personality and biases dominate the record like the flash on a camera washing out an image and removing all the contrast. Also, history is written by the winners. That doesn't just mean that it's written by the victors of battles or political contests. It means that history is written by society's winners. It's the people with resources and political control who have the most influence on what is written down. That means that most documents concern political leaders. Many would suggest that is okay. We should pay more attention to the people who have had more effect on the path of history. I'd countenance that, but many, including me, would argue that traditional history has the balance all wrong. It means that history, especially in the West, becomes a long list of mostly old, mostly men, and they're always white. Or, in the immortal words of Alan Bennett in The History Boys.
Can you for a moment imagine how depressing it is to teach 5 centuries of masculine ineptitude? Why do you think there are no women historians on TV?
No tits.
Hit that boy! Tits. Hit him!
Sir, you can't, sir! I'll tell you why. Because history's not such a frolic for women as it is for men. Why should it be? They never get round the conference table. In 1919, for instance, they just arranged the flowers, then gracefully retired. History is a commentary on the various and continuing incapabilities of men. What is history? History is women following behind with the bucket.
Again, drawing an earlier period in the development of Western thought, we are faced with these problems, but just to a greater extent. It is exciting that in the very early Anglo-Saxon burial evidence we see, if not female or social equality, then at least a debatable lack of clear man-led, male-led hierarchy. There are suggestions, even in the historical record, that the Anglo-Saxons were far more comfortable with women holding and using power than their Norman successors. The presence of Ethelfled, daughter of Alfred and Lady of Mercia, and Emma, continually frustrated queen of Ethelred Unred, and eventually astute Emma alongside Canute the Great, show documentarily that women could and did exert independency, agency and power. Save for these and a couple of other rare examples, the sheer self-obsession of documents during this period hides women and others in the shadow of self-confessed great men. History can often hide the complexity of the world as it truly is beneath the death masks of individuals. Which is why this podcast is an archaeology podcast first. We will not be avoiding historical documentation in this series, but use it to contextualise, comment upon, or illuminate the archaeological record. If this short but somehow still overly long section has made anything clear, it's that when we do bring documents into the show, they come with a giant asterisk. I will do my best to flag the particular biases and limitations of documents as they appear, but sometimes listenability and a desperation to avoid tedium will lead me to trust you all to hear the giant asterisk, even when it isn't explicitly commented upon. Let's not put down this period too much. There are advantages to a period which is smaller in size and more complex in evidence than the whole of prehistory. What grabs me about this period is that over the course of 700 years, we see many of the same themes play out over and over again. I can identify 7 major themes that I think are going to appear throughout this series, and I want to introduce them to you now so you guys can look out for them and maybe even notice connections that I don't manage to bring to the fore. Let's start with the economic themes. 1. Globalization versus localization. The Roman Empire did a lot. One of the things which is most visible is that by pulling together and directing the resources of nearly an entire continent, the empire became very efficient at extracting and using wealth. The empire reached its peak in both territorial extent and political stability during the time of the Flavian Dynasty and the 5 Good Emperors between 69 and 180 CE. Unsurprisingly, it's during this time that the Colosseum was built, as was Trajan's Column, the Pantheon, and much of the Palatine that we can still see today. These effective emperors sat on top of the greatest period of European interconnectivity and global connection until the Enlightenment. Both of those periods were marked by 2 things, economic growth for all and increased inequality. When the Western Empire collapses in the 400s, Europe's economy becomes far more localized. The burial and settlement evidence shows that societies became more equal. And over the course of the next 500 years, Britain and Europe became richer, more interconnected, and again, we see greater wealth for everyone, but also greater inequality. This pendulous swing between a global world and a local one is a vital element to understanding how society changed and developed during the early medieval period. We'll explore not just what promoted these swings between greater and lesser globalization, but also try and draw some lessons about the real-world consequences of these economic developments. 2. Trade and international relationships. All of this talk of globalization can become very grandiose and theoretical, but another theme will be the processes that either lie behind or result from these general developments. One of the more fascinating elements in the immediate post-Roman period is the near collapse in trade with the continent in every region of Britain, save for those with little Roman interaction. It's odd and contradictory. Regions like Cornwall, which had very little Roman control, kept a relationship with the Mediterranean world, and it appears that for at least a century, Cornwall's tin kept merchants coming from as far away as the Black Sea to trade with them. The wealth and connections gave early medieval Cornwall a particularly distinctive regional personality during a period defined by distinct regionality. Trade and the particular connections British regions have to other regions are going to have significant political implications. For example, Kent's close connection to the continent is going to make it very, very rich and very, very French very early on. This gives Kent some of the earliest towns in Britain, places like Canterbury and London, because of that trade and the continental connections. Something comparable will have an effect on East Anglia and Yorkshire during the 900s. Their strong trade connections with Scandinavia will not only make their economies more maritime in nature, but also give those regions a more distinctive Norse culture and political system. This is most visible at Viking York, which, as we discussed, you can get a taste of at the Jorvik Centre. Well, once the world gets back to whatever normality will look like. Speaking of political developments, though, there are a few political themes to discuss too. For example, number 3, the development of hierarchy. Hierarchy is something we spoke about a lot last season, and honestly, I think it is something we'll talk a lot about throughout this podcast. Archaeology is historically most interested in social structure and the nature of organization, and social differentiation is a vital part of that. So, considering that we've spoken so much about it, let's move on quickly to number 4, colonialism, which is a much bigger and much more contentious topic than the development of hierarchy. When it comes to how we interact with the public, there are two schools of thought in archaeology. The first is that archaeology is nothing more than a curiosity. We are free and privileged because we get to talk about things that are genuinely fascinating, but archaeology cannot contribute to modern debates. I do not agree with that view. I'm in the second camp. This view states that if archaeology is to indulge its innate curiosity, it also has to be able to provide context to current discussions. The early medieval period, as we've said, is an inherently political one because it deals with not just the formation of modern nations that make up the British Isles, but it also deals with the foundation of the rivalries and outright hostilities that have and sometimes still define the international relationship we have today. This isn't just the period which serves as the beginnings of the mostly good-natured ribbing between England and Wales. It's also the beginnings of the strong sense of national identity in Scotland, often defined by being not England, which is obviously a still vital conversation in modern Britain. And, of course, it's during this period when the complex, usually antagonistic, and oftentimes violent relationship between Britain and Ireland becomes a common feature of British politics. Even when talking about a period 1500 years old, Brexit is screaming in the subtext. We're not cowards here, though, and this podcast has shifted from being decidedly apolitical to one which will discuss unavoidable political mountains with an attempt at good humour and sensitivity. And I apologise in advance if sometimes I prioritise good humour over that sensitivity. One of those issues is colonialism. I'm going to shift into a slightly more academic mode here because colonialism is, if you've somehow not noticed, a bit of a hot topic right now. Chris Gosden, in his book, Archaeology of Colonialism, convincingly argues that colonialism isn't a period running from the late 1600s to the mid-1900s defined by white men invading and pillaging anywhere that wasn't Europe. Instead, Gosden suggests that colonialism is instead a constant in human relationships and is one which is defined by how the movement of material culture affects both the colonizer and the colonized. His conclusion is that we do not live in a post-colonial world, and that actually post-colonial is something of an impossibility. Instead, what he argues is that we are trying to get away from a particularly bloody and dismissive form of colonialism. What he shows is that the nature and form that colonialism takes is dependent on the balance of power, the nature of each group's ideologies and what they are trying to achieve. When those views are in opposition, colonialism can become very violent, as we saw in Africa in the late 19th and early 20th century. However, when the power, aims, and ideology of the acting agents are complementary, like in the Northeast USA and Eastern Canada during the 17th century, when colonialism can become a productive relationship, changing each group equally. All of which is to say, colonialism is a complex process and a sensitive topic. However, it is also an important element during this period. The nature of Anglo-Saxon settlement, the British response to that settlement, as well as later Viking invasions, Christian conversion missions, and Frankish interference all hinge on our understanding of colonialism. So yes, we will be talking about colonialism a lot, but we're going to aim to do it in a way that can inform modern conversations without necessarily speaking directly to those modern conversations, save to elucidate important or obscure points. Is that okay? Okay. Now, obviously, one of the things critical to any talk of colonialism, as well as globalization and international relationships, is the interplay between different ideologies. Ideology is the third category of themes we'll explore. For example, number 5, Christianity and paganism. This one is pretty obvious. We've spoken about it quite a bit already. It's the biggest traditional debate during this period. Britain, after Rome, it was Christian, and it's from Britons that men like St. Patrick go over, convert England. But then the Saxons arrive, and they bring their paganism with them, which comes to dominate lowland Britain. However, those Celtic Christians who are converted by the British begin to convert places like Western Scotland, and then they are joined by Rome, who begin to convert southern Britain. There are then the ideological debates between these two types of Christianity, with Roman Christianity coming to dominate most of the country until the Vikings return, bringing their version of paganism with them and starting these debates all over again. This second wave of paganism prompts some serious soul-searching among the Christian community, which leads to a less fun, more Frankish style of Christianity, creating the classical view of medieval Christianity we see in the many abbeys and monasteries which litter swathes of the British countryside. This is a complex process which I wish to flag here, but not to dive into any more right now, as more than any of the themes, we will explicitly talk about Christianity and paganism and their relationship. Instead, let's briefly discuss two ideological elements which are important to much of what happens, but when compared to the religious developments, seem sometimes underplayed or understudied. The first of these two is number 6, nationhood. That's a big word, nationhood. In fact, it's a little too big for much of our period. But I couldn't find another word. What I'm talking about here is an internal, unified sense of identity within a specific region. We see a sense of shared identity early on in history with Gildas, who writes, quote, "Concerning Britain's second subjection and harsh servitude, concerning religion, of persecution, the holy martyrs, many heresies, of tyrants, of two plundering races, concerning the defence and a further devastation, of a second vengeance and a third devastation, concerning hunger, of the letter to Aegeus, of victory, of crimes, of enemies suddenly announced, a memorable plague, a council, an enemy more savage than the first, the subversion of cities concerning those who survived, and concerning the final victory of our country, that has been granted to our time by the will of God," end quote. Admittedly, this is a modern translation, I don't speak Latin, but even in the late 400s, a man could write and be understood to be talking about a country with a shared identity. Over time, we will see more often wars and violence, not between two rival groups for control of resources or just glory, but wars against kingdoms for harms done to the kingdom itself. Nations will develop and will reach their full force when Canute the Great can write a letter to the English in which he refers directly to Dane and Englishmen, recognising the presence of two regions within the one kingdom he ruled. Nationhood is not nationalism. Nationhood is an awareness or an identification with a particular region, heck, maybe even an awareness of or identification with a particular culture, which we'll come to. Nationalism is a particular way of seeing how nations and regions should interact with each other, and includes ideas such as the right to self-government or a belief by a person that one nation is the greatest simply by virtue of being born there. It's a modern idea, but it draws on much deeper ideas which begin to develop during the early medieval period. What is behind much of nationhood is a sense of a shared past. How many times has the Western world in the past year encouraged their citizens to stick with lockdown by drawing on the Blitz spirit here in Britain, or the same spirit that got us through the American Great Depression in the USA, or the idea of French resistance and a long history of patriotism which defined much of French culture? A lot. That's how many. One of my favourite areas, and a really vibrant area of archaeological research, is how people use material culture to create and interpret their pasts. To do as we are doing here, telling ourselves stories about humanity and using those to add more to our sense of self. And that's our last theme, number 7, cultural memory. How people can use material culture and communicate with each other about their past, how to tell stories about their past, which then informs the culture in which they live. These are the major themes, the concepts that have kept appearing during my reading for this period. Within episodes, there will be a multiplicity of themes. Some that will be present for a single show, and others which will appear for an episode or two, only to disappear and then reappear at a later date. That's because this season is far more structured and interconnected with itself than our first season. I'll explain how after the break. An intro episode. This is getting very, very long. But before we bring things to a close, I want to explain to you very briefly the structure of this series, because it has two clear halves, and you know, I should warn you all what you're getting into. The first half of this series is currently planned to take us 9 episodes, and it will take us those 9 or so episodes to cover about 200 years of history. This is the period that is truly dark historically. Gildas and Beedar are pretty much only lights. There are the occasional glances from continental sources in Britain's direction, but otherwise, we're only relying on archaeology to talk about this period. In fact, we'll mostly use sources if we use them in this episode, to summarise viewpoints or to provide a nice literary flourish to illustrate what I'm talking about. Also, we're starting here and diving deeply here because this is, for me, the most complicated and most interesting period to be studied. The archaeology is often new, often unpublished, and as we've rhapsodised for long enough already, often very relevant to modern debates. Also, it's for the show, it's during this period of 450 to 650 that has all the best burials in the period. Think sites like Prittlewell Princely Burial or Sutton Hoo. There's a lot that's good about Christianity, and Christianity has given us some fantastic archaeology, but Christians are usually very, very dull when they get buried, which, I'll be honest with you, was something I didn't take into account when decided to go with this period. The second half of our series will be, essentially, an archaeological companion to the many other podcasts that talk about the later half of the early medieval period. This covers the time from when Bede was writing, through the establishment of the major kingdoms, the Vikings, Alfred the Great, the birth of England, the Danish period, and finally, the Normans. We'll visit towns and churches, discuss massacres and warfare, and also try and show how the rest of the people coped with the tempestuous political weather. We'll also use archaeology to try and posit why things happened in the way they did. We'll explore ideas of agency, people choosing to act, and structuralism, the relationship people have with the social system in which they live. We'll also discuss climate change and geographical pressures that force people to act in a way that is at once disturbing and fascinating in equal measure. However, not for the last time, I'll say that we will be led by the archaeology, with the written evidence playing an important but subsidiary role. If you want to hear about the political story, then as I've said, do listen to the podcast like the British History Podcast. We will take, at the moment, a planned 10 hours to cover the period from 650 to 1066. Jamie the BHP has already spent more than 100 hours talking about the same period and hasn't reached 1066 yet. But anyway, that's enough spoilers. Let's bring this thing to an end. About to head on a long monthly journey through one of the most exciting periods of history. We'll discuss the origins of medieval kings, ancestors to Queen Elizabeth II herself, and we'll see the beginnings of the development of a uniquely English style of politics that led to parliamentary democracy and the United States Constitution. We'll see the beginnings of not just the modern British nations, but also the modern regions that define how so many of us still think of ourselves. We'll also watch the struggle of brave, brave men with deep, deep religious beliefs converting this country to what becomes Roman Catholicism, an organisation of such consequence and influence that it's kind of hard to grasp. I'm so excited for you to join me, and I'm so thankful to the growing number of you who are supporting the show with reviews, likes, shares on social media, and of course, on Patreon. Whilst we're here, welcome to Kate, our latest Patreon, who's already given me some great suggestions for where to take the show, and reminded me once again that this show is at its best when it's telling Welsh research stories about the past. And I hope this season will do all of you proud, and that you will enjoy it as much as I'm going to. I'll speak to you soon, and the next time you hear from me, I'll be an Oxford man. I'm Andy Earnshaw. This is Old Bones. See you soon.